Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. And today I want to introduce you all to a writer you probably do not yet know. He is here from Iceland. His name is Sjón, S-J-O-N. And he is a magical writer, one of my friends to whom I've given these books, and I've given them already to many people, said, oh, it's as if the magic realism of South America has traveled to the frozen north. It's as if the stories in the classic epics were being retold by someone who does not come from that culture, and then putting them side by side with stories from Norse culture, and the friction between them creates sparks, but they're not sparks of heat. They're sparks that come from, say, the blade of an ice skate on the ice. A.S. Byatt calls you a magus. Are you a magician, in a sense?
Antonia's words are very big, you know, and at least she's put the mark very high for me to aim for. So let's say I'm aiming to become a magician of words. But what you're saying is absolutely right. In my books, I work with world literature. I mean, I work with the great world heritage. And I try to see what happens when that world heritage is put into contact with my Icelandic heritage. And of course, the Icelandic sagas, which were written in the 13th, the 14th century in Iceland, you know, are a part of the world heritage of literature. And you can say that in a way, the magic realism has returned to its source, that is up in the north. And we are rediscovering it and putting it into contemporary context.
Now, as I understand it, you began as a madman, and you're making your progress toward magician. You wrote Dada kind of poetry, wild, surrealistic. I managed to find a very rare book of your poems, no longer available, translated into English with the Icelandic on the facing page, but randomly.
Yes.
And you also write lyrics for songs by Björk, including those for the movie.
Dancer in the Dark.
So, it's a lot of fun. We might be sounding like, oh, epic Icelandic saga, Edda, but no, it's a joy. It's a joy to read, and if they are carefully crafted, it is because they are carved out of ice, yes?
That's one way of putting it, yes. I like to have fun when I'm writing. You know, I try to stay true to the rule of really enjoying the process of writing. I enjoy the process of researching. I am, you know, an active reader. I was a reading kid. I want the reader to be having a good time, even though the subject matter can be very cruel or it looks complicated or whatever. You know, I want the reader to be having a good experience floating on whatever ocean, you know, I've taken him or her to.
The newest book to be translated is called The Whispering Muse, and it's published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. And in it, the ship, I think it's Argos, yes?
Yes.
That carried the Argonauts.
Yes.
Yes.
Athena, the goddess, came to bless the ship, and in fact so much so was her patronage of the hero Jason, that she becomes herself the prow of the ship. Many, many, many years later, one of the sailors carries with him a sliver of that masthead.
Yes.
And he holds it to his ears, and it tells him stories. He channels the stories that come directly from the goddess via the sliver of wood he has. And I thought I'd ask you to read a portion of one of the goddess's dictated stories.
Well, the speaker is Ikeneus, who was one of the crew members of the Argo. He's quite special, even in Greek mythology, because he's one of the very rare examples of somebody who metamorphoses twice. I mean, to metamorphose once is quite enough for most people, you know, to go from a human being to a constellation or a tree or a wolf or a spider.
Or a pig.
But Canius, he metamorphoses from a girl into a man and from a man into a bird. We put out a boat and two of the crew piloted the ship to the harbor site. There we reefed the mainsail, moored the ship and stepped ashore. The first reaction of a man who has come ashore from the sea is to wonder that the earth should be so firm beneath his feet. This lasts for an instant, before being succeeded by another sensation that feels as if it will never end. Thirst. In an instant, all the salt that one has inhaled from the sea is released from one's lungs to crystallize on the tongue, coating it like a glittering iron glove. And only one thing can quench that fire, wine. It should be mentioned here that this crew consisted of no weaklings, but of the greatest heroes known to man. Each and every one of us could have steered an entire fleet to victory. Each and every one of us had the courage to meet whatever foes may be, whether of human or monstrous kind. But before thirst, even the greatest champions must concede defeat. We raced off up the wharf, for all the world like a swarm that has found the rotting carcass of an ass in a cabbage bed, making a beeline for the first tavern that met our eyes, and charged over the threshold with a great yell of jubilation. But our joy was short-lived. The yell died on our lips. It was a ghost town. There was nothing there but a layer of dust covering the benches and tables. We broke into the next tavern, and the next, and the next. Everywhere, the same sight met our eyes. The wine barrels had burst, and the long-desired drink moldered black as blood among the broken staves. Oh, the disappointment. We turned on our heels and trudged back to the ship with aggrieved complaint. When Jason, son of Aeson, saw his sailors returning to the quay so woebegone, he grew thoughtful. And on hearing that the dock area had succumbed to moths and rust, he ordered us to prepare without delay for battle with the monster that had evidently destroyed all human life on the island. He sent Phalerus, skilled in feats of arms, into the city to spy it out, and with him the huntress Atalanta, the only woman among our number. They were well armed, as always, when there was the prospect of a hunt. These two had not gone far before they returned to the ship, leading between them a golden-haired maid that a group of terrified women had sent out to meet them. In her lily-white hand, the girl held a papyrus scroll. The troop of armor-clad heroes stood aside, opening a path for the small maiden to the gangway where Jason greeted her. She handed him the scroll, which the son of Aeson unrolled and read with interest. The rest of us waited. Soon we would know whether plague or a monster was responsible for the sinister state of the land. Meanwhile, the stout midshipman Heracles set the child on his knee and performed tricks for her amusement. A manly smile played over the lips of Jason, son of Aeson. Looking boldly to shore, he raised the papyrus scroll to the skies and shouted in triumph, "My friends, we find ourselves on an island of women." And what a joy for the sailors, they think.
Sean, reading a passage from The Whispering Muse. Now remember, okay, a splinter of wood is telling a story to a seaman who is telling the story to a crew. The crew includes one rather, boorish guest whose interests are in herring, primarily. Herring and fish. But the other parts of a sea epic are not as interesting to him. So he regards this all as blather. He has his own stories to tell about how fish created the integrity of the Norse character, the northerner. Now, tell me about that integrity.
Well, yes, on board we have Valdimar Haraldsson, this old man, completely obsessed with the relationship between fish consumption and the greatness of the Nordic race. He's survived the Second World War by collaborating with the evil forces. He doesn't hesitate to admit that he was working on the Berlin radio during the Second World War. And I was really interested in working with a character who had, let's say, quite unsavory ideas that he was trying to smuggle out of that great tragedy into our times. And he's completely obsessed with this, and he doesn't see anything wrong with these ideas. So when he's faced with one of the greatest storytellers of all time, telling one of the greatest stories of all time that is coming directly from a goddess, he just can't let go of his bad ideas and his bad story. And one of the things that I wanted to do with the book was to make this rendezvous between the absolutely banal and narrow-minded and the big heritage that we see in the great epics of world literature. Because on one hand, this is something that we all experience every day. I mean, we all share the great burden of the great classical tradition. But still, we are faced with the banalities of our lives, you know.
And the guest on this brand new ship is something like someone who's never gotten over the Nazi youth days. He's essentially eugenicist. He believes in the superiority of one race over others and that this superiority is caused by herring.
And, yes.
And he is marvelously ridiculous. It's a relief to see such a character become a figure of fun rather than a figure of terror. You know, we are not frightened by him. We kind of pity him.
Absolutely. And it was quite a challenge to sustain a whole novel with a character like that, you know.
And to make us laugh.
And to make us laugh.
Love him.
Yes, because, I mean, he's obviously, I mean, he's very old. We get to know that he's poor. So he clings to these ideas that he is of a great race. And I think it speaks quite honestly about how people find comfort in bad ideas and evil ideologies. Some people have like real need for them, no matter how sad that is. He's one of those people. But hopefully, at the end of the book, when he discovers that the splinter has, let's say, a positive effect on his nether parts, he stops worrying so much about herring and temperature and becomes more interested in his neighbor, the widow Lauritsen, and the possibilities of maybe having sex again.
Yes, yes. For the first time in years, this magical cure coming from a splinter of wood, stories that restore his arousal.
Yes, and you know, one of the things that mythologies are about is renewal, is the renewal of the universe, is the cycle of life, and that's why Eros is always so important in these stories. The world is renewing itself,
and it's a ball passed between Athena and Aphrodite, between knowledge and sensuality.
Absolutely.
And they are in competition for the world.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Sean about his novel, The Whispering Muse. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Sean about his new book, The Whispering Muse, Tales Told at Captain's Table That Weave Notions of Superiority and Mythology on a Maiden Voyage. Now, one of my teachers, the sublime and unforgettable John Barth, also worked with the stories of the gods, the goddesses, the heroes in his book Chimera. I think of The Whispering Muse as a combination on the one hand, and just trying to situate for people who may know these compass bearings, between John Barth and the structural pleasures of complexity. And on the other hand, one day, a woman named Mariana Frisch, who was married to Max Frisch, brought a book to Donald Barthelme. Donald lent me the book. We were all astonished by it. It was called Christianity Under Glacier by the Icelandic Nobel Prize winner Halldór Laxness. He was known for novels of immense realism in which sheep ticks were counted carefully, but this book, Christianity Under Glacier, was so original and so funny and so wild and poetic. Are you in love with that book?
Yes, I like that book very much because the wonder that Laxness does there is that he manages to make all these layers of reality exist together, you know. And the people take the supernatural for granted, you can say. And they live a very, at the same time, they live with, the relative hardship of being on the edge of the civilized world there under the glacier. They live quite a strong intellectual life, you know. They're thinking about the big things and enjoying talking about the big things and acting out philosophies on this small stage up there in the north. So it's a fantastic book.
You see, what I love is Max Frisch to Mariana Frisch, Mariana Frisch to Donald Barthelme. Donald Barthelme gave the book to me. I gave it to Susan Sontag, and it became one of the very final things she wrote about before her death. She got so excited. She called me, having read it, as always, overnight, and said, "Michael, it's a masterpiece. Uh-oh. It's a true masterpiece. And now Americans who want to buy that book can buy it with Susan Sontag's introduction."
Oh, I'm very happy to hear the story of how that came about, you know, and that you were a link in it.
Well, you see, it's an honor.
Yes.
Because the link also, I am reading the New York Review of Books. A.S. Byatt, Antonia Byatt, has an essay on Schoen. I read her essay and say, I must read these books. And because they were so wonderful, I got all of them I could, including a very rare and out-of-print volume of poetry, obviously an earlier stage in the process toward what you are doing now. And now, what, nearly a year later, we are talking, and it feels destined that what you're talking about, that juxtaposition of traditions and cultures, is also a juxtaposition of readers and writers, that we read and we write and we pass it along, and by the time the passing is done, we have created a counterworld, one better than the one that was thrown at us, the one that we messed up. This other world is the one we live in by preference.
Yes. I mean, the journey of stories is an amazing thing. I mean, the human being seems to have a natural thirst for hearing stories, for getting the news from faraway places. Obviously, I'm someone who has experienced that very strongly, living in this tiny community in Iceland, in the North Atlantic, where you really rely on news from the big world to question your own society and your own values and your own traditions, and hopefully it leads to enriching them and a rediscovery of elements that we have taken for granted.
You see, in a way, outside the links, it makes people frightened and angry to hear that literature comes from literature, that this story gave birth to the next story and the next, and that one entered the spirit of this writer who told it, and that telling entered the spirit of that writer, and that the more you read, the more you see the beautiful chain work of the eternity of storytelling, and that that is in itself a part of the experience of our need for stories, to see the braid of how a story becomes another story. Your hero gets metamorphosed twice. A story in the course of its life gets metamorphosized countless times.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, just as musicians are picking up rhythms or chords or whatever from faraway places, writers are doing the same thing. And I mean, we are writing the history of the human race together, all of us, the authors that we have from the very beginning, the very oldest tales and songs, and the readers. And it's interesting that that readers are sometimes scared of this notion that this book springs from another book, while they themselves are in the process of recreating the book they are reading at that very moment.
Well, it's always the fear that we don't know enough, that we'll enter the forest of literature and get lost there and not be able to find breadcrumbs or any other marking device to help extricate us. But I would like to suggest that being lost is one of the thrills of having a mind and of dreaming and of living. To not get lost is only to know what you already know. To get lost is to be swept away by the possibility. So much better to get lost in a story than to get lost in anger or lost in a war. There are many ways to get lost, but stories are the best ways.
Absolutely. What I want to say is that let's not forget that when we begin to read as children, One of the most important things we're going through is understanding and not understanding. And I think that process should continue, even though we have become adult readers. Yes. There is always this game of understanding, not understanding. Sometimes it's a word, sometimes it's a situation. And, you know, that's where we want to be. It's about understanding, not understanding, finding our way from one to the other.
Because otherwise we might become an elderly man whose belief devolves to the importance of herring. Who wants to end up with that as the most important thing in life?
Yeah, there you go.
I've been talking with Sean, author most recently of The Whispering Muse, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, who have also published in beautiful editions a couple of other novels, The Blue Fox and From the Mouth of the Whale. The books, for me, are an enchantment. And thank you for coming and talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Sean is here as part of Penn's World Voices Festival. He has come here from Iceland. I have come here to New York City from Los Angeles. We have traveled the world to bear this inquiry to fruition. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show from The Whispering Muse at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to our magnificent recording engineer at Carnegie Studios, Leszek Wojcik, and thanks to Jane Parshall, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
A bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Lydia Davis is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.